Falter-Podcasts werden durch Werbung unterstützt. Das hilft bei der Finanzierung unseres journalistischen Angebots.
Hereinspaziert durch unser Burgtor. Ob Burgherr, Ritterin, Stallbursche oder Gauklerin. Die Burg Liechtenstein in Maria Enzersdorf bei Wien lädt zu Erkundungen ein und weckt bei Groß und Klein die Abenteuerlust. Erbaut im Jahr 1130, ist die Burg bis heute zu 60% im Originalzustand erhalten. Waffenkammer, Turmzimmer und Ritterstube. Die Stammburg der Fürstenfamilie von und zu Liechtenstein bietet Einblicke in das Leben im Mittelalter. Besuchen Sie uns jetzt in der Erlebniswelt Burg Liechtenstein. Jeden Sonntag mit eigener Kinderführung. www.burglichtenstein.eu.
Falter Radio, der Podcast mit Raimund Löw.
Sehr herzlich willkommen, meine Damen und Herren, im Falterradio. Kein Land Europas hat das Ende des Kommunismus so radikal erlebt wie Albanien. Unter dem Diktator Enver Hoxha war das Land nicht nur von den westlichen Demokratien streng abgeschottet, sondern auch von Titos Jugoslawien und dem gesamten Ostblock. Die Politikwissenschaftlerin Lea Ippi hat ihre Kindheit in Enver Hoxhas Albanien verbracht. Ihre Familie war verdächtig, weil der Ururgroßvater in der vorkommunistischen Zeit einmal Regierungschef war. Der Vater war als Klassenfeind im Gefängnis. Das kommunistische Regime in Albanien kollabierte 1990, wie überall sonst in Osteuropa. Viele Menschen haben das Land in der Folge fluchtartig verlassen. 1997 sind alle staatlichen und wirtschaftlichen Strukturen zusammengebrochen. Es war das größte Chaos, das man sich vorstellen kann. Bilder von riesigen Schiffen, auf denen Menschentrauben hängen, die heraus wollen, gingen um die Welt. Aber danach begann mit internationaler Hilfe ein erstaunlicher Aufstieg. Albanien ist heute eine parlamentarische Demokratie, NATO-Mitglied und Beitrittskandidat der Europäischen Union. Lea Ippi, unsere Gesprächspartnerin, ist heute eine gefragte Politikwissenschaftlerin in Großbritannien. Sie hat über ihre Kindheit im albanischen Ultrastalinismus ein Buch geschrieben mit dem Titel »Frei, erwachsen werden am Ende der Geschichte«. Mit Tessa Šišković hat Lea Ippi im Kreisky-Forum über ihre Erfahrungen gesprochen. Zuerst liest sie den Anfang ihres Buches, zuerst auf Deutsch, dann auf Englisch.
It starts with the first pages from the first chapter, which is called Stalin, and so I'll read now in German. Ich habe mich nie gefragt, was Freiheit bedeutet. Nicht bis zu dem Tag, als ich Stalin umarmte. Aus der Nähe wirkte er viel größer als erwartet. Unsere Lehrerin Nora hatte uns erzählt, Imperialisten und Revisionisten stellten Stalin gern als kleinen Mann dar. Doch tatsächlich sei er nicht so klein gewesen wie Ludwig XIV., über dessen Körpergröße selbst Dante Weih sei niemand redete. Jedenfalls fügte sich Ernst hinzu, sei es ein typisch imperialistischer Fehler, sich auf Äußerlichkeiten zu konzentrieren, statt auf das, was wirklich zählt. Stalin war ein Riese und sein Erbe weitaus wichtiger als seine Statur. Was Stalin so besonders machte, fuhr Nora fort, war seine Fähigkeit, mit den Augen zu lächeln. Ist das zu glauben? Mit den Augen lächeln? Es lag daran, dass sein freundlicher Schnurrbart die Lippen verdeckte. Und wer nur auf die Lippen achtete, würde niemals erkennen, ob Stalin gerade lächelte oder etwas anderes tat. Doch es genügte ein Blick in seine Augen, stechend, intelligent und braun, und man wusste Bescheid. Stalin lächelte. Manche Leute schaffen es nicht, anderen in die Augen zu sehen. Offensichtlich hatten sie etwas zu verbergen. Stalin hingegen sah einen unverwandt an, und falls ihm danach war und man sich gut benommen hatte, lächelten seine Augen. Meistens trug er einen unscheinbaren Mantel und schlichte braune Schuhe. Außerdem schob er sich auf die rechte Hand und das linke Revers, wie um sie sich aufs Herz zu legen. Die andere Hand ließ er oft in der Tasche. In der Tasche, fragten wir, ist es denn nicht unhöflich, mit der Hand in der Tasche herumzulaufen? Die Erwachsenen sagen uns immer, wir sollen die Hände aus der Tasche nehmen. Nun ja, sagte Nora. In der Sowjetunion ist es sehr kalt. Außerdem, fügte sie hinzu, hatte Napoleon auch immer eine Hand in der Tasche und da hat keiner behauptet, es wäre unhöflich. Nicht in der Tasche, sagte ich schüchtern. In seiner Weste. Zu seiner Zeit galt das als Zeichen für eine gute Erziehung. Lehrerin Nora ignorierte mich und wartete auf die nächste Frage. Und er war klein, ergänzte ich. Woher willst du das wissen? Meine Großmutter hat es mir erzählt. Was genau hat sie gesagt? Sie hat gesagt, Napoleon war klein. Aber als Marxes Lehrer Hangel oder Hegel, ich weiß nicht mehr, ihn gesehen hat, sagte er, man könnte den Weltgeist auf einem Pferd stehen sehen. Hangel, korrigierte sie mich. Und Hangel hatte recht. Napoleon hat Europa verändert. Er war ein Wegbereiter der Aufklärung und ein großer Mann. Aber nicht so groß wie Stalin. Hätte Marxes Lehrer Hangel Stalin dort stehen sehen, natürlich nicht auf einem Pferd, aber vielleicht auf einem Panzer, hätte er ebenfalls von Weltgeist gesprochen. Stalin war eine wichtige Inspiration für viele Menschen, nicht nur in Europa, sondern auch für Millionen unserer Brüder und Schwestern in Asien und Afrika. Okay, jetzt auf Englisch. Did Stalin love children? We asked. Of course he did. Even more than Lenin? About the same. But his enemies always tried to hide that. They made Stalin sound worse than Lenin because Stalin was stronger and far, far more dangerous for them. Lenin changed Russia, but Stalin changed the world. This is why the fact that Stalin loved children just as much as Lenin was never properly reported. Did Stalin love children as much as Uncle Enver? Teacher Nora hesitated. Did he love them more? You know the answer, she said with a warm smile. It's possible that Stalin loved children. It's likely that children loved Stalin. What is certain, dead certain, is that I never loved him more than on that wet December afternoon, when I scampered from the port to the little garden near the Palace of Culture, sweaty, shaky, and with my heart pounding so hard I thought I would spit it on the ground. I had run as fast as I could for a couple of kilometers when I finally spotted the tiny garden. When Stalin appeared on the horizon, I knew I would be safe. He stood there, solemn as usual, with his unassuming coat, plain bronze shoes, and his right hand under his coat as if supporting his heart. I stopped, looked around to ensure that nobody was following me, and went closer. With my right cheek pressed against Stalin's thigh and my arm struggling to circle the back of his knees, I was not visible. I tried to catch my breath, closed my eyes, and began to count. 1, 2, 3. When I got to 37, I could no longer hear the dogs barking. The thundering sound of shoes stamping on concrete had become a distant echo. Only the slogans of protesters occasionally reverberated. Freedom, democracy, freedom. Democracy. When I became certain of my safety, I let go of Stalin. I sat on the ground and took a more careful look. The last drops of rain on his shoes were drying out, and the paint on his coat had begun to fade. Stalin was just as teacher Nora had described him, a bronze giant with hands and feet much larger than I'd expected. Tilting my neck backwards, I lifted my head to confirm that his mustache really did cover the upper lip and that he smiled with his eyes. But there was no smile. There were no eyes, lips, nor even a mustache. The hooligans had stolen Stalin's head. I covered my mouth to suffocate a scream. Stalin, the bronze giant with a friendly mustache who had been standing in the garden of the Palace of Culture since long before I was born, decapitated? Stalin, of whom Hengel would have said that he had seen the spirit of the world on a tank. Why? What did they want? Why did they shout freedom, democracy, freedom, democracy? What did it mean? Okay, I'll stop here.
Although the next paragraph is really, really good, but people should read the book and then they will know why it is so good. Thank you very much. I mean, your German is wonderful. Where did you learn such good German? I mean, you speak basically every language.
I never actually learned it. I had to read Kant for research. And so I learned by reading texts and never really learned it. It's one of my things that I never managed to learn it properly.
Well, it's incredible. I mean, we know from the book that you spoke French as a child already, and, you know, a small country, although it was closed off, you came from a family where people spoke different languages and they kept it up with the next generation, although it was maybe not always looked upon graciously by the party censorship to see what people would be doing. Anyway, so you are hugging Stalin here as a child. Yeah, it is just the end of the Hoxha regime in Albania. And it's a very, very strong impression that we get in these first chapters when you describe with such, not nostalgia, but with such sympathy, how safe and how good your life was at that time. Would you say that's the right impression we get?
Certainly, it's the right impression from behind the veil of ignorance about what reality was, in the sense that I try to reconstruct from the eyes of a child what it meant to live in this society. And what the book does is to take the reader on a journey in which they discover, as the child does, the reality of the place in which he lives. So my childhood was, yes, a very safe, a very sheltered environment. Albania was very isolated. I had never left the country, although we knew a lot about other countries from children's magazines and from the news, and also from Italian television, which people would access sometimes in secret, and also with repercussions of censorship and so on. But I grew up in a school in which I was told that Enver Hoxha was the greatest man who ever lived, and that Stalin and Lenin were also important heroes of the socialist revolution. And in a world in which a lot of countries had betrayed socialism, Albania was one of the very few countries left who were serving this kind of pure ideal, and I believed in the ideal. And my family did nothing to undermine that narrative. So on the surface, it's a stable childhood surrounded by people who love you and by the comfort of a life that is predictable, even with all the constraints. The book talks in the first part about the queues, about what it was like to go to school, about what it was like to meet foreigners in Albania at the time in which it was extremely isolated. But the child doesn't really know what else is going on except from what she sees immediately. And the reader also doesn't know, except for what they see through the eyes of a child, until they get to the middle of the book, and then something happens and things change.
Yeah, but you describe, for example, very strong the scenes where the influence of your teacher, Nora, so the indoctrination of the kids in school was very strong. She was very important for you to make sense of the world. So everything would be discussed, and she would tell you how, you know, right or what right or wrong was. And I think that's quite interesting, because I, for example, don't remember that from my childhood, that the teachers had a particular influence on us. So that was really something that describes this kind of real socialist regime where the mind was actively, you know, we of course were also living products of our society in Vienna, a few kilometers to the north from you, but it wasn't taken in hand by so much by a very strong ideology teaching in school. And do you remember that you how strong the conflict was for you between what you learned in school and what your parents were and your grandmother were talking about at home?
So for me, the discrepancy between what I got in school and what was going on at home was always just revealed in the form of mysteries. So for example, I grew up speaking French with my grandmother in a country in which nobody spoke French. There were no French minorities. It wasn't an official language. My grandmother didn't speak with a French accent. She spoke with an Albanian accent. She had never been to France. And so it was very strange to have this language that was my first language, my first encounter with the world, that was very different from how everyone else interacted in Albania. And that indicated to me that there was something going on in my family that was a little bit different from other families, other Albanian families. But the school and the society was heavily politicized and indoctrinated. The only sources of political information came from the school and the nursery, and it started very early on with children. So it was a very censored environment, and it was really difficult. And other things that were going on were, for example, my parents always refused to have a photograph of Enver Hoxha displayed in our living room, where the norm for a lot of Albanian families was that they would pay tribute to the leader of the country by exposing the photo in the way in which, I guess, in Catholic families you'd have a cross. So there's always, as you mentioned, a symbol of something that matters to people in every society. And whenever I asked why we didn't have it, they always made excuses and didn't really say anything to immediately undermine what I was told at school. They made me believe, and they nurtured the kind of narrative that I was being fed at school, which was that I was a good pioneer, or I was going to become a good pioneer, and I was a good citizen, and I wanted to serve the country, and I wanted to help society and help people outside Albania as well achieve what Albania had and others didn't. So I lived in this bubble, and my parents didn't really burst the bubble at any point. There were things that were going on between them, conversations or conflicts or things that I picked up when Enver Hoxha's funeral, for example, happened. They didn't seem to be too upset by what was going on, or not as upset as I was. And I remember I was watching this funeral being really devastated, and they were talking about the funeral music. And so I have these kind of glimpses of memory from early childhood in which I asked myself, are my parents as loyal as they think they are, or they say they are, as I think they are? Because sometimes it seemed that it wasn't the case, but they spoke in code language between them, and so it was hard for me to interpret at that point what was going on.
Well, it's also, I mean, we know this also from Russian novels and histories of where the parents were just terrified to think that their children would tell on them if they would tell them the truth about the political regime to their teachers in schools or to whoever, just somebody outside in the shop on the playground, and then people would get in trouble with the political police. And so your parents must have been really in pain to develop this code language, as you say. And so you described this in the book very well, how people would say, somebody graduated from university, and what they actually were talking about was somebody was released from prison. And it was even sort of what they were studying was sort of, you know, what they were sitting for and how long and all this. And this, of course, you as a child didn't understand, first of all, because you were a child, but also because they were very good in hiding it.
Yeah, and also I often wondered, so at one level they did this to protect themselves, because it was very dangerous. If I had gone out and mentioned that, you know, my family were dissidents and that came from a history of political persecution, that there had been people in the family, including my grandfather, who went to prison, my great-grandfather was killed. So there was a number of people who had really, their whole lives had been shaped by these tragedies of repercussions and purges that had happened over the course of Albanian history. And so this would have basically made them constantly a target where they try to forget the past and to suggest that they were also being good citizens and trying to pretending to integrate so that they wouldn't be ongoing repercussions. But on the other hand, I think there was another element which I've thought about later. It's the fact that I was a really ambitious child and really wanted to succeed and wanted to be a good citizen and a good pioneer. And they were worried about killing that ambition if they revealed who we were, because at that point I would know that it would be impossible for me to succeed in this communist society, coming from this family background where you're basically the class enemy. And since I was very motivated, I think they hoped that at some point I would make the transition by myself and discover this truth by myself at the right time. And then I would retain something of this ambition that I had to integrate in a communist society kind of going forward for the future. So it was in part because I think they wanted to protect themselves, but in part because they wanted to protect my aspiration and my kind of desire to be a good student and a good pioneer. And they felt there was something that, even if it was in the wrong society, in kind of corrupt moral circumstances, there was still something admirable about having a child who wants to do that. And they didn't want to destroy it, basically.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Very complicated situation for parents, to not be able to, you know, educate you and tell you what they were really thinking all over all these years. And it's quite interesting because, as you say, your family background, they came from not only from people who were not necessarily communists, but they were sort of upper class Albanians, especially your grandmother, as we learn also later. And this sort of is sort of a theme in the book, that social classes and what happens to them throughout these very strong sort of changes in society. And we have a particular sense that you felt more comfortable in the it maybe wasn't as free, but it was, you know, it was, everyone was more or less the same, and you didn't feel the terror that you the grown-ups were under.
Because I think I try to explore this idea of freedom from different angles. And so there is, of course, a sense of freedom that is embedded in the political context and in the political environment, where people, if they're unfree to express their political opinions, or they're unfree to get together with other people who think similarly, to associate or to travel or whatever, for them, these are very harsh, oppressive circumstances to live under. But if you're a child, as I was, children don't really have sophisticated political opinions. In fact, they, you know, the political opinions that I had were the opinions that I was given by my teacher, and which I endorsed because I had no reason to challenge them. And so apart from that, I think to a child, freedom really is just this very immediate sense of feeling protected and feeling loved by your family, or feeling that you can go outside on the street and not being worried about, you know, crossing the road. Or I remember the only things I was scared about were barking dogs, and my mother was very brave and she always sort of said, oh, don't worry, it's fine. And so I think it was a very safe in that sense childhood. And because I think for children, the main component of freedom is safety, it also felt to me like a free society. And from a child's perspective, it was, and if your parents, if you live in a sheltered family environment where the parents do nothing to undermine that sense of safety, but instead encourage it, then it becomes even more this sense of kind of comfort. Even with the scarcity and the difficulties that we had to get, for example, basic goods. I was very picky as a child. I didn't like a lot of things that, you know, were being sold in the shops, and the shops didn't have a lot of things anyway in the first place. So if you didn't like what there was, you were left with very, very little. And my parents had to make these huge sacrifices to get me like honey rather than jam, which was the stuff that you would find more easily. And so they went out of their way to make sure that I didn't feel the discomfort that they felt. And that's why I grew up in this kind of very protected environment.
Well, you describe also in one of the very nice chapters, the hunt and the fight over a Coca-Cola can that was used not to actually drink it, but it was empty. It was traded between the neighbors in the village, and it was then put up on the shelf as a special thing, like an art piece. And that gives us, of course, the sense of the poverty and the also reclusiveness of Albania and being cut off from the world. But then at the same time, you were the star talking to the tourists because you could communicate in French. And that again is such a strange idea that, although, you know, we in Austria, for example, grew up with this feeling that Albania was the last sort of Stalinist island in Europe at that point, at the end of the 80s. And as a lot harsher in as regime as it was in you know, Yugoslavia, neighboring countries. But you, of course, didn't know that because you had no way to compare it. You could have never traveled outside and left the country.
Yeah, and the one thing that really stood out also, I think, and this was important to me when I wrote the book in trying to explain the relationship between Albanians and the outside world, was that people assume that when a society is very totalitarian, very oppressive, then they're completely brainwashed and they're unable to think and see for themselves what's going on somehow. And that's, of course, the position of the children. But in the case of the grown-ups, everybody went out of their way to find information and to try and access stuff that was outside the boundaries of what was permitted by the party. And so the result was that Albanians actually knew a lot more about the world than the world knew about Albania, because they were keen, they were curious, and they were trying to find information. So I remember we had this relative who would describe the streets of Rome in such detail as though he'd been there. And of course, it was only from films and books. But people couldn't travel physically. And so they traveled with their minds and they just read everything they could read and found all the access to the information they could find. And this is why in this chapter where I talk about my encounter with the tourists, my sensation was that I knew a lot more about them than they knew about me, because they assume they're meeting this little girl from Albania and it's kind of like an exotic thing for them. Whereas for us, the foreigners were also exotic to some extent, but with more work to prepare about what the world was like. And of course, it was a world that was in some ways also very idealized. And we didn't really know the thing is, the bad sides of that world, the negative aspects of it, were reflected in Albania through communist censorship and through communist material. And so we knew about exploitation and poverty and social injustice and discrimination against minorities and so on. But because it was all coming through communist propaganda, when communism fell, people just thought, well, that was also part of the lies that were being told. And so that everything was left about that world was the stuff that was good about it, that had somehow survived this communist filters. And so this was also in some ways shaping this relationship to the West that went from being, you know, people being extremely positive about it and extremely keen to integrate afterwards to the set of delusions and the difficulties that came afterwards when they discovered that it wasn't all as they had imagined it would be.
Well, that's how we experience it on the pages of your book, that the moment happens, and it is for a child who believed everything that it was told. The biggest shock is not only that you have to readjust to the whole thinking, but also that you understand that your parents never had the same admiration for Enver Hoxha that you had for Comrade Enver. Yeah. And so that must have been a terrible traumatic shock to your system.
Yeah, I think I remember it as being very, very confusing. And something that I think has also left a mark, in the sense that if you believe something very, very strongly once and it collapses and you told it's just everything you believed was true turns out to be false, then I think it's really hard to believe afterwards in anything. And this is what has actually stayed with me, and I suspect stayed with a lot of people from Eastern Europe, is the sense of diffidence about everything that they're told. Of course, there was in the early 90s this moment of great belief in this other world and in the freedom, in Western freedom, and this new idea of democracy that everybody would realize at some point with the fall of communism. But I think very soon after, that was replaced by the sense of skepticism and this crisis of faith, which I'm not sure anyone in the region has really completely recovered from, this kind of trauma. So in my case, it was emphasized and made worse by the fact that it came also with a crisis of faith in the family. So literally, there were no institutions left that one could trust. You know, you can't trust, of course, everything's going on in society, but you also worry how much can your parents guide you through this transition if they, you know, if they have lied to you for such a long time. And so you don't know who to look up to and what to believe. And I remember it as a time of really great confusion, coupled with afterwards with quite a lot of resentment during my teenage years about the sense of responsibility that I felt that, you know, the truth was revealed to me when, but without me looking for it in some ways. And so when I wasn't ready for it. Mm. And therefore, this process of maturity was kind of interrupted in this very abrupt way. And that made it very, very hard.
I mean, for one of the most impressive scenes in the book for me is that on the day of the first free elections, your parents don't go and rush to vote, but they stay at home, and because they were, you know, they were staying under the blankets, and they said, like, no, it's too early. And your father is checking if the voting count actually, if the people who go to vote, it doesn't jump to 100% in the first 2 hours, because then you would have known that it's another unfree rigged elections.
Yeah, exactly.
As a reader, you are in this scene and you start understanding what they must have gone through, while you, of course, are just wondering, what is going on? Yeah, why can't they go? And so we understand how unsure they were also of this process.
Absolutely.
Not ending up in being arrested by the Sigurimi, by the security services.
So yeah, exactly. And I think that's also really another thing that's really important afterwards, when you reflect on these moments of change, these moments of revolution, where with a distance, they seem very sudden, and the change seems very sudden. But when you're living it in the moment, it's not clear that it is a change. You don't know it. You only know afterwards that this was forever, that this change, that communism was falling forever. But at the point in which they were living it, they weren't at all sure that this was actually going to last, that there wouldn't be repercussions, that the elections wouldn't go a completely different way. So when you're in this moment of transition, the same sense of diffidence that I had when I was told, you know, about all these new changes, they had when they were looking up to the future and to this new society, which they didn't quite believe was going to come. And so the sense of fear never went completely immediately. It took a long time to readjust to these changes.
Well, first of all, ideologically, as you write that socialism was gone, communism was wiped away, the idea of it was wiped away, and the only thing was left was freedom. But you didn't experience the freedom as a child, but also your parents, not necessarily as something, you know, they had hoped for it, but it didn't really work very well for the structure, neither of the family, nor of the village, nor of the whole country.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I try to explore these different ideas of freedom. And so there is a sense in which there's a kind of general philosophical concept of freedom, and then how it gets politically realized. And so in the case of my, and I try to explore these different conflicting philosophical ideas of freedom, where, for example, my mother has what I consider a classical liberal idea of freedom, which is a kind of negative freedom, where you are free insofar as the state doesn't tell you what to do, what to wear, where to go. And in that sense, she did get that freedom because, you know, she went from being someone who couldn't speak her mind up to being politically involved in the opposition party and running a women's organization, and was quite prominent in that women's organization. So in some ways, all the freedoms that she had lacked under communism, she obtained afterwards in 1990. My father was like, and so this kind of purely liberal idea of freedom, of free from state intervention, that's exactly the kind of freedom that Albanians try to realize, and indeed all of Eastern Europe tried to get after 1990. But there's different understandings of freedom. So there's a more social, more robust, as I think of it, robust idea of freedom, which is not just you have to be free from someone, but you also have to be free to realize yourself and to emancipate and to realize you have to have the opportunities to become someone. And so if you're hungry, if you haven't got a job, if you haven't got money to travel, if you haven't got education to be able to speak up properly, all of these become forms of unfreedom, even though nobody is actually stopping you from having them. And so in the case of my father, I try and explore how this becomes really comes alive, this dilemma, in the second part of the book, where he goes again from being a member of a dissident family who is at the mercy of his employers and at the mercy of the party, always persecuted, to being in charge of running the port of Duros, where he's a CEO of the port, and is in charge of actually privatizing and delivering these new neoliberal reforms. And it's really hard for him because he's gone from being the victim to being someone who delivers these decisions, who he knows will have an impact on workers who will lose their job. And everyone in the narrative of the 90s presents this as, this is just what it takes to liberalize, this is just what the market requires. And then it will be a sacrifice in the short term, but in the long term, it will work out for everyone because the market will deliver for everyone. But in his case, he sees the immediate impact of that on people who are standing in front of him and saying, you know, don't sack us, don't make us lose our jobs. So it's actually really hard for him to make these decisions and to see that as a form of freedom. He sees that as a new type of oppression. So in a way, the book tries to explore through the different characters, and then my mother has yet another idea of freedom. The book tries to explore through the different characters how this philosophical idea, which we all seem to intuitively understand, how it then comes alive when history gets in, and how, when, you know, there's politics and when institutions try to realize that idea.
Well, it's also, we know this dilemma, of course, also from other former communist countries in Eastern Europe, that the transition to freedom and the market economy and capitalism and tossing out everything that the communist system had offered led to a lot of disappointment, because, you know, some of the reforms came in harsh and some also maybe were wrongly orchestrated, yeah, so too fast or in the wrong direction, or, you know, privatization wasn't always done in a way that protected the jobs, of course, of the people who worked there. But some of the factories, of course, needed to be closed. Also, you know, the problem that your father had was that it just wasn't far from lucrative or profitable for the new owners, and all these kind of things that you know, in Eastern Germany, we had the first and biggest debate about it, because it was so visible how and the communist German part had to be transitioned to, yeah, to Western standards. And of course, this took a long time and a lot of resentment. So I wonder if you, because you described this, of course, also in the book, that Milton Friedman and Friedrich von Hayek replaced Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels. If you would think that it was a mistake what happened in Albania, that things went too quickly, or that there would have been a way to make it more, you know, better organized for the people, because it's quite difficult to stop history from happening when, yeah, when the bandwagons are rolling.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's very hard to know counterfactually at what point exactly something different could have been done. I think one of the problems, especially in Albania, but also maybe in other countries, was that we didn't have a democracy dissident movement that had developed during communism, as there was in the Czech Republic or in Poland, where there was a bit of a kind of internal movement to democratize, because it was so repressive, there was basically no opposition. So people went from having this very dogmatic commitment to communism to having a very dogmatic commitment to the exact opposite, with no effort to find ways of learning from experiences of the past and to get the best from both systems in a way, and try to reflect and to have a proper social movement that would articulate in a more critical way how should this transition be done. And how they went, and people just basically listened to the experts, so the World Bank and the IMF. And I remember when my dad was running the port, you know, he was constantly talking to these international experts. But in the end, the international experts never know the local context as well as the locals know it. But the problem was that the locals had lost their faith in themselves. And so they weren't able to push back and to say to the foreigners, look, you know, we know better the context. We know how these social relations work. You can't just completely disrupt this. So it was a very difficult dynamic, because it had to do with, I think, the lack of confidence in a people who emerges from this repressive regime, combined with the extreme confidence of the outsiders who come and say, you know, history has come to an end. And this is partly why the subtitle of my book is Coming of Age at the End of History, because it's the Fukuyama idea, which meant that the collapse of the socialist world entailed immediately the triumph of everything opposite this kind of liberal world. And so the word, the key word was, you know, liberalize, privatize, open up the markets, open up trade, just absorb the costs, because the market, and this is just the Chicago school of economic thought, you know, this is just what the ideology prescribed, this idea that you make these short-term sacrifices and in the long run there will be a reward and the costs will be absorbed. And people went with this faith, which was in a way the same kind of dogmatic faith as what they had had before when was communism was being replaced and it wasn't working, but people were saying, oh, but we still have this ideal and we need to serve the ideal. And they just went from having one ideal to having another ideal. And literally, I remember as a child burning the books and replacing them with other books. I mean, I have these scenes of my people in my neighborhood one day literally burning books from Marx and Engels and Lenin and so on. And I went home and said to my dad, I need a book to burn because everybody else is burning books. And my dad was like, no, we don't burn books in this house. But it was really, even symbolically and even kind of visually, it was such an extreme transition from one way of doing things to another way of doing things, which was the exact opposite. And I think, yeah, it would have been better to have a more critical perspective from the inside developed in a more democratic way that would also, I think, resist this paternalism of outsiders who came to Albania with recipes about what needed to be done.
Well, you describe how one of these opposition politics comes to the house and knocks in desperation and says, I need gray socks because the American advisors say that white socks are impossible and you can't win elections or be elected in white socks. So he needs gray socks and he doesn't have them. And so he took the ones of your father that your grandmother knitted.
Yeah, literally. I mean, this was, and I remember also when my dad was an MP, literally there were these leaflets printed in English that said, this is what you need to wear. This is how you need to appear in front of the cameras. This was also the years, you know, late 90s, when there was this beginning of this kind of politics of charisma and personality politics, where it mattered a lot how the leader looks or how it wasn't, the debate had really been deprived of substance and it was all about visuals. And it, which is to some extent, I guess, what also we still experience now, where it's a lot about social media presence and, you know, appearances rather than what people actually believe or how they articulate what they believe or voicing sort of political opinions that have more substance to them.
But in Albania, you went through a really, really rough patch then in 1997, where practically the system collapsed, you know, and it's a part of the book where you actually quote your diary, because you're 17, you are going to the end of your school days, and it's really quite scary to think that it was, for you, I think you're right, it became completely normal to have school proms with guns and bombs going off during exams. And so it was a wild period for the family, but also for you.
Yeah, it was really difficult and also very difficult to explain, which is partly why I have the diary rather than trying to describe what was going on. Because I remember when I started writing this chapter, I was trying to write it in a narrative way in which I had written all the other chapters. But the thing that I found really difficult to explain was what it means to go through war and how it's never either or. So you're never in war or outside war. Even though from the outside perspective, a country is in war and a war is the same for everyone, it's actually not like that. You're either, you know, you're in a safe place or in a less safe place. There is a time of the day in which it's okay to go out and a time of the day in which you have to look after yourself. There is times where, you know, there's electricity and everything feels normal and it looks like everything's going to be fine. And there's other times where you hear the guns and you think, I'm going to die now. And you get really, really scared, literally, for your life. And this, almost this kind of schizophrenia of being in war, I found really hard to explain in a coherent way with the voice of now, because I looked at these diaries and it really was the way I've let it then be on the page. It really was one day you're a teenager and you're thinking about your people you love and you're thinking about school and your exams and your future. And another day you think, what is the point of all this? And it was really hard to articulate that in a kind of narrative way that would make sense to the reader. And so I gave up. When I was writing this chapter, I gave up. And I remember talking to my editor and said, you know what, I'm just going to just leave the diary as it is and let people make of it whatever they will make of it. But at least they will know what it was like and they will live it in the first person as it was read and kind of lived by me back then. But it was really difficult also because while in 1990, it felt like a complete collapse of society, just like the ones that we had had in 1990. But while in 1990, I was a child and there was this hope from everyone. You know, my parents were hopeful and the general mood in society was one of optimism and this transition into this world that we've been longing for and waiting for. In 97, there was a sense of complete failure of everything and the sense of, what is the alternative? There is no alternative now because, you know, how do you recover from this very quick shock? One system fails and then another system also fails because the 1997 war was caused by a financial collapse in the end. So it really, people did what they were told to do, which was to invest and save money in these financial companies. And then the financial companies broke and they lost their savings. And then that led to protests and unrest and the state lost its capacity to even control the kind of basic law and order. So I remember in 97, I had more awareness. I wasn't a child. I'd gone through these kind of teenage years, which I had felt were years of a lot of responsibility also, of kind of generational responsibility, because I was growing up with this idea that now everything is possible for you. And so you have to deliver on the hopes of even those who didn't have any hope or that can't deliver anymore because they're too old. And suddenly all of that came to an end and it was a really brutal way of meeting and thinking about the future.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and it wasn't only in Albania. If you think in Russia, you had a collapse of the financial system too in 97, 98. And that led relatively straight to Vladimir Putin being put in place there as first as prime minister, then as president in 2000. And we know what happened ever since. So in Albania, actually, it was maybe more messy, but also less, the results now, the nowadays political system is less, doesn't lead to such desperation like we see it in Russia today, where one man kept in power for 22 years and is now turning his country into a new isolated, almost Stalinist, fascist regime, mm-hmm. where we have no idea how long it will take to get out of that hole again. I mean, Albania is a bit more of a hopeful place, is it now?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, although I always, on the one hand, I'm a very optimistic person. On the other hand, I think it's always good not to be complacent about what you have in place, because I think democracy is a very fragile thing. And it's actually a process rather than something that's consolidated and you have and it's there forever. It's something that you need to protect by being active and by being aware and critical in such a way that you can always promote change that is forward-looking rather than backward-looking. So for me, I mean, the thing I always say about Putin and Russia and also many other countries which have these authoritarian governments is it's never about the individual that is there. It's about the phenomenon that the individual is channeling. It's about the grief and the sense of unrest and the social conflicts that are on the ground going on for many, many years before any of these contexts comes to anyone's attention. There is stuff going on the ground that people, Western media or liberal opinion makers only pay attention to contexts like that when there is a war or when there is a kind of catastrophe, basically a humanitarian catastrophe and so on. But usually there's a process that leads to that catastrophe. And there is also, to some extent, interactions with our governments in the West that leads to that as well. So it's not as though there is stuff going on there that's completely independent and there is a man that abuses power and so on. Usually the abuse of power reflects something deeper that's going on in society for a long time, which needs to be protected while it's going before it's too late. And so I always think also the same about democracy, that there is no democracy here and authoritarianism there. It's always a matter of degree, and it can always change, as we know from history that countries that have liberal constitutions then become authoritarian countries, and countries that are authoritarian then eventually manage to kind of democratize. So it's always a process and it's always a flux, and what's really important is to engage with the process in the right way. And by that, I mean in a way that enables people to maintain an interest in politics and a hope in democracy and in this kind of process of democratization that prevents these forces of reaction, of conservative fascist tendencies from monopolizing the dissatisfaction of citizens, basically.
But that's the interesting thing, what you did in your life then, since you were this Albanian child admiring Stalin in 1990. And looking up to Comrade Enver, you wanted to study philosophy when it came your turn to become a student, and your father was relatively shocked because he was more for a precise science like physics or something that could be, you could put both feet on the ground, and philosophy seemed to him at that point, maybe in history, also a really very difficult to make, to think about different schools of thought and different schools of ideology and what to do with it. He maybe was scared, but for you, it seemed to be a relatively logical development because your childhood was entrenched in politics. It was entrenched in political thought. It was entrenched in philosophical studies that your parents had. So you maybe wanted to just explore it and become an expert yourself in it? Or why do you think you chose this track and now ended up teaching Marx in 2022 in London, the capital of capitalism?
Yeah. So I think a lot of it had to do with the contingency of the circumstances in which I was making this decision. So it was 97, as we said, the school, there was a lockdown, Kalashnikovs everywhere, the school was closed, I had to do my A-levels and I had to decide what to become in the future. And my family was very skeptical because they always associated philosophy to Marxism and to party and to this kind of very dogmatic way of understanding the left, I suppose. And they were always insisting that you have to pick a profession. But in this moment of complete collapse of the state, for me, it was really hard to think of the profession. So I kept thinking, what do I do? Do I study law? And you kind of look outside your window and you realize that the state has no capacity to protect law and order. It's just collapsed. Or you think, what do I do? Economics. And then you're in this context where all the financial companies have collapsed and the banks are unable to give people savings. And there's this kind of all of the economic orthodoxy that we were having up to that point is completely destroyed. Or you think, you know, what can I do? Medicine. And you have all these people who are dead next to you and there is no kind of humanity anymore. So I remember that I kept going through this, what my parents called professions, and kept thinking about what is the point of all this in these circumstances, because it was a moment of such nihilism. And I was only left with questions. And then I was like, well, what is the field that enables you to ask questions? And it was philosophy for me. It was a way of just articulating better questions and engaging critically with the world. And then I got to, and so I left and I decided to study philosophy. And I promised my father that I would not study the kind of philosophy that he was really hostile to. But then, of course, when you engage with the history of thought, and if you are in some ways, you're the result of this very hard process of making yourself autonomous, of making yourself independent, of being critical and trying to develop this criticism, regardless of all these forces of ideology that you've had to resist throughout your life. And then you encounter a particular author or a particular thought. You don't say, oh, well, now I can't do this because my dad told me not to do it. And so you kind of go with the flow of the criticism. And for me, one of the reasons that I became really interested in leftist thinking and kind of socialist theories more generally was that I discovered a resource that was, first of all, a repository of thought and resources that were much more than we had ever thought there was in Albania. So in Albania, we only did this kind of very restricted part. But then in Italy, I was in contact with the Italian left and with Gramsci. And so there was, and with, you know, the social democratic tradition. And so I discovered that there is a lot more to socialism than what Albania had assumed that there was. So in part, it was a kind of critical gesture. Secondly, my grandfather, my ancestors also came from the left and had been repressed by communists in Albania. So for me, it was a way of recovering their efforts to try and think, okay, what is this other way of thinking about the left, which is not the Albanian way of interpreting it? And thirdly, actually, a lot of the criticism resonated with me. So if you read Marx's Critique of Capitalism and you've lived in this kind of wild capitalism of early 90s Albania, a lot of it makes a lot of sense. You know, you hear about the kind of the destruction of social solidarity, you hear about alienation, you hear about this, the way in which social relations are fragmented, and you read it and it's not that abstract. It actually feels like you've seen some of this. So there was a way of, for me, recovering a critical perspective on the society in which we live, on London, which, again, you mentioned London is the capital of capitalism. And it's true. I mean, London is an extremely wealthy city, but you just get out of the center for a few kilometers and you discover a completely different reality of injustice, of poverty, of social marginalization, and so on. And this is meant to be one of the world's most powerful states. So you see this phenomena of asymmetric power, let's say, and you then look for resources, philosophical and political and cultural, that enable you to engage with these phenomena and to try and make progress and to be critical and think about the future in a different way.
Well, you describe it also in the book, how you study with Western European students, and they just dismissed your view of what socialism was as something that it wasn't the real socialism. And in a way, you can, of course, your firsthand experience of it, of course, could have also led to the total opposite, and that you would have not been at all in the mood to engage in Marxist studies or in socialist studies in that sense. So I wonder if it was a little bit also a rebellion against your liberal parents at that point, because they sort of, they rose and also failed in a way in this liberal struggle. And it wasn't their fault, of course. I mean, they were really thrown into the midst of history, or the end of history, as Fukuyama would have said. So one of the chapters, the very, very dramatic chapters of history. So was it a bit of or is it still a little bit in a conversation with your parents and the way you debated politics at home?
That's one way of putting it. Another way of putting it is it's an effort to preserve their idealism. So it's just a kind of refusal to put up with the circumstances that we face and to accept the status quo and to say, oh, this is what we're stuck with. And we just have to operate with the constraints of the world that we live in. And this is why I say in the epilogue, I have this sentence where I say, if you see the system change once, you start thinking, well, it can change again, because you have seen this kind of moment of rebellion against injustice. And it stays with you, this desire to move forward. And this also the idealism, I think, stays with you. And this refusal to just become cynical and to become apathetic, which I feel very strongly in Eastern Europe is, and then maybe that comes from philosophy as well. There is a sense in which people don't really believe in the system that they're stuck with, but they also don't believe that there's an alternative. Whereas I think it's okay to be dissatisfied, but you have to believe in something, because otherwise it's just, you know, where do you go with nihilism and pessimism and skepticism about everything? It's not really a productive attitude for the future. So I suppose one part of it is, yes, a rebellion and a kind of rejection of some things that my parents believed in. But another part of it is, I think, an effort to actually preserve their efforts, to preserve their commitment and to preserve the things that they believed in, and to try and engage with the circumstances that we live in now in the best way we can and in the most critical way that we can. And for me, philosophy was one of the thought was one resource and one way of playing that kind of role in society of being a democratic agent and thinking about, you know, how to make democracy real and to also see where it's not, where, you know, where it's ideology, where people are told you live in a free society and you have to protect these things, but then you discover that it's actually not the case. And so also to kind of cope with the crisis that we face.
Das war ein Gespräch mit der albanischen Autorin und Politikwissenschaftlerin Lea Ippi im Bruno Kreisky Forum vom 2.6.2022, das Tessa Šiškovits geführt hat. Beim Kreisky Forum bedanke ich mich sehr herzlich für die Zusammenarbeit. Ich verabschiede mich von allen, die uns auf UKW hören, im Freirad Tirol und auf Radio Agora in Kärnten. Lea Ippis Buch »Frei, erwachsen werden am Ende der Geschichte« können Sie über den Falter Buchversand bestellen. Politische Bücher und Literatur aus aller Welt, darüber erfahren Sie regelmäßig im Falter. Alle Informationen über Abonnements oder ein Probeabo bekommen Sie im Internet unter der Adresse abo.falter.at. Ursula Winterauer, Designation gestaltet, Philipp Dietrich betreut die Audiotechnik im Falter. Ich verabschiede mich bis zur nächsten Folge.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hallo liebe Hörerinnen und Hörer, hier spricht Florian Schäuber. Mein Podcast Schäuber fragt nach läuft wieder auf einem eigenen Schäuber fragt nach Kanal. In der neuen Folge berichte ich über einen mit Regierungsinseraten gesponserten Hitler-Fan und den bevorstehenden Auslieferungs-Hattrick des steirischen FPÖ-Chefs Mario Kunasek. Mit der Philosophin Susan Nyman spreche ich über rechte Fans der Postmoderne, Rasterlocken und Parallelen zwischen Benjamin Netanyahu und Donald Trump. Jetzt auf Schäuber fragt nach, überall dort, wo es Podcasts gibt.